All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And once again, I have to say the show is jammed today. We're going to move through it, though. It's going to be bringing you a lot of different things that you need to know about, including at the last part of the show, at the end of the show, we're going to be talking about the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, which is on the road now. We're going to be talking with Sansara Taylor, a writer for Revolution Newspaper and one of the initiators of the StopPatriarchy.org movement. And we're going to be talking with her about the Freedom Ride, what's behind it, what's going on, where they're going, what the plans are, and what's it got to do with you, all right? And in the middle part of the show, we're going to be talking about a study that just came out that talks about how, basically, why does breast cancer more likely to kill a black woman in America than a white woman, all right? And we're going to be talking with one of the lead authors of a new study on that, and his name is Dr. Jeffrey Silber. We'll be talking with him about what the results are, how does that show, and what does it mean, and what's the importance of that, and why is it happening? And opening the show up, I'm extremely pleased to welcome to the show Marilyn McMahon. Marilyn is executive director of California Prison Focus, and she's one of the attorneys who's like deeply involved in the California prisoner hunger strike. And Marilyn's been, we talked with her during the last hunger strike, and she's always right up there on top fighting for around all this and making all the stuff known to people everywhere about what's going on and why it's important. Marilyn, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, let me start off by, I want to read something before we go on, just to give you, just to set this in a little sense. This is something that came in just recently. It's from Eugene Jarecki. He's a filmmaker, made the film The House I Live In, which is all about mass incarceration, and he's also an activist. And he said, "It's a sad time in America. Wherever we look, we see apathy where vigilance is needed. Acquiescence where an alert and engaged citizenry is the last hope for this nation to remain even remotely true to the principles articulated in her Constitution and Declaration of Independence. We see villains and charlatans enthroned, and worst of all, we see heroes vilified. We see the government and a willing media malign and denigrate heroic and courageous whistleblowers who shine the vital light of truth into the darkness of our corrupted national soul. And now we see the least powerful among us, the least of our brothers, as the Bible teaches, those warehoused and denigrated in our nation's gulag system of industrialized mass incarceration, standing up for themselves and indeed for the rest of us. They, more than anyone else in this weary land, despite the injustice and bleak cynicism of their incarceration, seem to have somehow retained, more than you and me, a conviction to see the better angels in our nature win out over the lesser. It is they who, by starving themselves, intend to show us the emaciation of our national character. And it is they who send a message that not even a corrupt government and compliant media can silence, that voluntary starvation is a fate better than that provided them by the grotesque calculus that has led this nation in one of its darkest hours to put profit, political and economic, ahead of people, of the American people themselves. As Eugene Debs taught us, while there is a soul in prison, I am not free. Today we must poignantly modify that refrain, while there is a soul in prison who would sooner take his life than cave to the harrowing oppression of a predatory system, I am participating in that system with my silence and with my next meal eaten as a free man. It is time for the state of California to recognize the deep validity and extraordinary courage of those who are putting this issue where it belongs, at the top of our national discourse. It is indeed a day for California to find a place on the side of the angels and not look back from a future time when it missed a chance to move on the right side of history. I send today my deepest respect and love to those striking in this extraordinary demonstration, and I send my wishes to the people of California to find the compassion in their hearts to recognize the heroism of their fellow incarcerated citizens." That's Eugene Jarecki, filmmaker and activist. So that's sort of, I wanted to start off this segment with that, and I know it was a little long, but it was very moving, I think, and very important in terms of people out there in society taking a stand in support of the prisoners. And I wanted to ask you, Marilyn, I mean, you can comment on that if you want, but
I just want to say, beautiful! What an eloquent statement.
Yes. I'll send it to you later on. I'll send you the statement if you'd like it.
Thank you.
Yeah, he really wants to get it out everywhere. So I wanted to ask you, though, why don't you give us an update of what's happening with the prisoners right now?
Well, there is a lot of retaliation going on. The primary thing that we know is happening. Everything from, of course, hunger strikers being thrown in administrative segregation, where conditions are even worse than in the SHUs, the security housing units, which are the extreme long-term solitary confinement units and really the hub of the issues that the hunger strike is about. But ADSEG is worse in that prisoners in there are locked down virtually all the time, and they don't even have a TV or radio in the SHU, at least while they spend decades there. They can at least watch TV or listen to the radio, but in ADSEG they have nothing. We hear reports that mattresses are being put against the doors to block whatever air might come in under the door, or whatever sound, any possibility of the prisoners talking to each other, or what the prison's so afraid of, that they might pass food to each other even while the prison urges them to eat. We hear of them being written up, given disciplinary violation notices for not eating, for peacefully sitting in their cells and not eating. That's being called a violation, a mass disturbance, and they're being written up, which will hurt their chances of parole and good time credits and getting out of the shoe faster if they're already there. Extreme temperatures, they're being blasted with cold air if they're in a cold prison like Pelican Bay, or with hot air if they're in a hot one in the Central Valley. They're denied showers. At Corcoran, they went for 10 days without showers or the opportunity to shave. They don't get yards, such as it is. For shoe inmates, that means exercising in another concrete cell that's bigger than their usual concrete cell, and so on and so on. Pain medications have been cut to prisoners, even with chronic, debilitatingly painful conditions. There are other medical alternatives that could be used, but instead the physicians just cut the pain meds, and we can only see that as retaliatory.
You're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Marilyn McMahon from the California Prison Focus and one of the main attorneys involved in the California prisoner hunger strike on the side of the prisoners. Now, Marilyn, a couple of other things that I heard about. One is that they've also apparently refused to let family members of the prisoners take part in any of the mediations that were scheduled.
Yes. There is a group of us. We're advocates for the prisoners' demands, and we try to keep communication open with the department so there's an opportunity for them to negotiate, even if they won't go directly to the prisoners, which is preferable. And we have on our team two family members of prisoners in the SHU, very articulate women who are most directly affected, or more directly affected than the rest of us. And they were barred admission to our meetings twice by CDCR. The official at our most recent meeting said he was afraid they would bring too much emotion into the room, as though when hundreds of men are starving in our prisons, emotion is not appropriate.
Yeah, really, really, just outrageous. Now, they've also, another thing that really, really got me angry, in addition to everything else you're saying, I just sit there in a constant state of rage all the time reading about this. You know, they've also really done a job in terms of demonizing the prisoners. I mean, it's so enraging when you look at this and they talk about, well, these are gang leaders and they're really just trying to get out of the shoe and get back into the main population so that they can actually further their gangland leadership and all this stuff. And it's like, you know, it's incredible. And this is in reference to a group of prisoners who actually issued a call to stop all kinds of gang-related and racial hostilities among the prisoners inside the prison and outside among the people as well.
That's right. And they asked the prison officials to post that notice, calling for all the groups of prisoners in prisons, jails, and also people on the street to stop racial hostilities, inter-ethnic violence. And they said, post it, you know, put it all over the prison. Let the guys know that we have agreed among ourselves to this, and we would like everybody to agree to this. And the prison official said, no, we're not going to post it. So what does that tell us about their real motivations? What does CDCR want? They don't want an end to violence like that? They probably don't, because if the prisoners unify, they have a lot more power. And so the prison system itself perpetuates these rivalries and the violence between different groups.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Marilyn McMahon, the Executive Director of California Prison Focus, and one of the attorneys deeply involved with the California prison hunger strike. Now, Marilyn, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, too, is that in relation to a lot of this, I mean, there's a whole thing that goes on here where, I mean, here's the thing. You're looking at all this, and the state has taken just a screw-you approach. We're not even listening to this, you know, you don't. And then Brown goes off to Europe and he's visiting. The cat has a sense of irony, but it's like, it's almost like he's doing it to shove it in your face. He goes and visits Dachau concentration camp. And you're like, this is almost something out of some kind of fantasy movie or something. It's just insane.
Really, isn't that true? I think it's tremendously cowardly of the governor, unless it's coincidence, which I kind of suspect it's not, that he went on vacation during the hunger strike. We have tried to get his attention. He's the one who should be addressing this, giving orders to CDCR at any rate to sit down at the negotiating table and meet the demands of the prisoners. And instead, he goes waltzing off to Europe. You know, the core demands of the prisoners are pretty much basic human rights law internationally recognized. Even the, you know, major newspapers have come out in this country with editorials saying, this is stuff that California should have done long ago. The demands are not unreasonable. They're, you know, give us nutritious, decent food. And indefinite solitary confinement. Right now, California will keep people in solitary confinement for life. And even though they tout that they've done all these reforms, under the new rules, they still can keep prisoners in solitary confinement for life. So, you know, the governor should just do it. Do the right thing. Grant these demands. Or stay in Europe and just give the call to the head of CDCR to meet the demands.
Yeah, and if pigs could fly, we'd all be much happier. Right? So that's a big point there. Marilyn, one thing I also want people to know is that you yourself have actually been banned from the prison and from contact with the prisoners now. And you're one of the attorneys that was able to to talk with the prisoners and to actually be able to communicate and bring news from the outside and bring news from the inside out to people. What happened there? Why were you banned, and what's the upshot of that?
Yeah, you know, the basic same thing happened in 2011, the last time prisoners went on hunger strike. A colleague of mine and I were both temporarily banned by CDCR, and they said we were under investigation. I never found out what I was under investigation for. And it was coincidental, I'm sure, that we were the two attorneys most actively advocating for the prisoners' demands. We were both kept out of the prison for the duration of the hunger strike. So we couldn't see the prisoners. We couldn't find out directly what was happening. Then, a little while after the hunger strike ended, the bans were lifted on both of us. No wrongdoing found. That's it. Oh, it just goes away, evaporates. Oh, sorry, we were wrong. So 2 years go by, no problem. I'm visiting, sending people up there every week. And the prisoners start a hunger strike, and I get the facts again. You're temporarily banned. I can only think it's political. And I expect that once the hunger strike is over, then the ban will be lifted.
Well, what's the impact of you being banned on the prisoners, actually?
Well, it means that I cannot see them. I cannot send my assistants to go see them. It means we don't get real-time information from the prisoners. We can get mail, but right now the prisons are holding the mail for at least 2 weeks, so prisoners are getting at least two-week-old news, and our flow is sporadic. We've gotten some mail in kind of timely fashion. It usually takes at least a week to get it, but I'm not hearing from a lot of prisoners I usually hear from at all. Mm-hmm. So it looks like mail may be held. But at any rate, you always have that lag time of mail, and if the mail is held up for a week or two, in hunger strike time, a week or two is a huge amount of time. We need to know what's happening today with the hunger strikers, and it prevents me from going and getting the information today.
Mm-hmm. And I think this point about hunger strike time is a really important one to emphasize to people listening today and people all over. Hunger strike time, this is actually what's concentrated in that is that every hour is an intensely important hour in for the prisoners and for humanity in general, but for the prisoners especially. This question of right now, every hour has an impact on their well-being, you know, and that's extremely important. And I think one of the things that, you know, when you're talking, I'm thinking, okay, you're not able to get the news out. The prisoners aren't able to get news from you, and they're not able now, the 14 that have been moved into a deeper ADSEG or whatever, they are not able to get any news from TV or radio or anything else. So then you have a situation where nobody has any news, nobody's dispensing anything, any information except the state. And what we've seen is the state keeps dispensing information that is meant to, well, you know, look, it's dwindling, the numbers are dwindling, everybody's okay, everything's gone, you know, we're just going to sit here and they're just going to have to learn their lesson that they cannot stand up and just yell for what they want. They're going to have to follow the rules. And this is what we get. You know, we don't get any more than that.
Yeah. What kind of regime does this remind us of, you know, where the state controls all the information? They keep people from getting any news of the outside world. They continually blast their own propaganda. They blast false propaganda. The guards going around telling prisoners, oh, the leaders are eating while you saps are still on hunger strike. You're the only ones on hunger strike. Everybody else started eating, especially the leaders. And you guys, why are you still on it? You know, that kind of stuff. Well, what kind of regime does that?
The Obama regime?
Information. We don't think the United States of America or California particularly is that kind of regime, but we're wrong. That's where it's happening.
Yeah, it does remind me of the Obama regime, I got to say. You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Marilyn McMahon from California Prison Focus. And Marilyn is one of the main attorneys representing the prisoners in the California prisoner hunger strike. You know, one thing I wanted to ask you, too, is that, you know, when we're talking about all this, and there's also something I thought was extraordinarily cruel. And it's hard to say something else that was extraordinarily cruel in a situation like this. But the idea that a couple weeks into the hunger strike, they passed around, or was it a film or some kind of informational packet that said, okay, look, now you're approaching a danger point because this is what's going to happen. And we want you to know what's going to happen if you continue to not eat. You're going to die. And we need to know, you have to make a decision about how you want to be treated if you go into a coma or on the way to death. This was something that was just extraordinarily, you know, cruel. It was just insanely cruel.
Well, you know, here I have to say, on the other hand, we do want them to know. We do want them to be informed. And that was passed out by the healthcare services. Mm-hmm. We want people to make informed decisions. Mm-hmm. And the really important thing that is that, indeed, the healthcare people follow the wishes of the prisoners, give them a chance to really express what they want and follow it. But, yeah, we want guys to know when it's dangerous and when it's not. You know, some of them were really worried after 3 or 7 days, and unless they started out pretty ill, they're not in danger then. The doctors say that the real danger point for healthy people, which doesn't mean prisoners who have been in long-term solitary confinement for decades, or most prisoners even are not all that healthy, but for healthy people, it's not really dangerous, as in they're not worried about you losing your life, up to 3 weeks. But at around 21 days, it changes. Well, today is day 19. So I'm sure we're in the critical zone already for prisoners who started out chronically ill or very weakened by prison life. And we're going into the danger zone for everybody. So the stakes are getting very, very high right now.
You know, we look at what's been happening in Guantanamo and how long that's been going on, and the question of forced feeding comes up. Is that a possibility? Do you think that the state would resort to forced feeding in relation to this hunger strike?
It is, of course, a possibility. What the state has said so far is that they will respect prisoners' wishes, so that if prisoners want, no measures taken to save their life should they pass out or become incapacitated. You know, they can write an advance directive that says that, and then the state will respect that. If they don't sign such an advance directive, then the state will try to keep them alive. Mm-hmm. I believe, I have heard this now third hand, but I believe that the medical people may be talking about doing things intravenously rather than the forced tubing, the forced feeding tube down the nose, which is an excruciating procedure. It really is a torture unto itself, even though it may be done sincerely to save lives. So we're hoping that forced feeding won't be used. It's so hard during a hunger strike to know what to hope for, Michael. You know, we don't want these people to die. Mm-hmm. And we want their strike to be effective. And if the state remains so intransigent, then they'll want to keep going to make the strike work and to get to win their human rights. So it's really hard to know what to hope for.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that is not hard to know, though, is that these prisoners are actually setting an example for people all throughout society. And I couldn't agree with you more on that. And thanks for actually schooling me on that thing about the thing, because I was just so enraged about the warning they gave. But it actually is true. People do have to make an informed decision about what they're going to do. And these prisoners have actually, a lot of them, especially in the leadership corps, they've made this statement that we are in it for the long haul. We plan to win this. We're not just doing it for ourselves. We're doing it for those that come behind us and, frankly, for the oppressed people all over the world. That broadness of mind is something I think is really something that has to be constantly raised to people in society in terms of getting support for these prisoners.
Yeah, and that they stand together.
All right, Marilyn, we're going to have to cut it now, but I want to have you back sometime soon. We'll keep you in touch. You'll be our correspondent for the prison hunger strike. How's that?
All right, very good.
Great, Marilyn. Thanks. Talk to you again soon. Thank you very much. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've just been talking with Marilyn McMahon, Executive Director of California Prison Focus, and we've been talking about the prisoners' hunger strike and the state of California's retaliation, including banning Marilyn herself and another lawyer from visiting prisoners. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Jeffrey Silber about a new study on the disparity in survival rates between black women and white women who have breast cancer. So stay tuned. Thank you.
arms are long. My hair is woolly. My back is strong. Strong enough to take the pain inflicted again and again. What do they call me? My name is Aunt Sarah.
All right, welcome back. That's Nina Simone with Four Women. And just recently a study came out that was focused up on the impact of breast cancer on black women and white women, comparing the survival rates of women who have breast cancer. It found that nearly 70% of white women with breast cancer lived at least 5 years after diagnosis, while only 56% of black women were still alive after 5 years. My next guest looked at that and said, something is wrong. He looked at that fact and said, something is wrong. And then he dug into it to find out what the hell was wrong. And his name is Dr. Jeffrey Silber. He's the lead author of a new study that digs into just what is wrong. He's also the director of the Center for Outcomes Research at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, among a lot of other things, but we don't have time to name them all. Dr. Silber, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, for having me.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. You said something's wrong and you jumped into it. What did you find out that was wrong? What's the character of your study? What did you find in your study?
Well, we found two main things. The first was that there's a very large difference in survival. You mentioned the five-year survival. If you converted that to median survival, we're talking about a three-year difference between whites and blacks in terms of how long they survive with breast cancer. And that difference was stable over the last few decades. So we haven't made any progress in the disparity between survival of blacks and whites. The second main finding was getting at why is this occurring? And we asked the question, is this occurring because of how sick patients are when they're first diagnosed with breast cancer, or is it because of the treatment that blacks receive that might be different than whites? So is the disparity in what we call presentation, your factors on diagnosis, the cause of the disparity in survival, or is it treatment that's causing the difference in survival? And what we found was that 2 years of the three-year overall difference in survival can be accounted for by how sick black patients are on admission when they first get diagnosed with breast cancer. And only a few months of the difference in the disparity in survival is due to disparity in treatment or differences in treatment between blacks and whites. So, we thought this was a pretty dramatic finding that we are in the very beginning when blacks are first diagnosed, they are much sicker, and therefore it's much harder to achieve the same survival rates that we would in whites.
You know, that's really sort of a mind-bending fact there, because, you know, a lot of times just, you know, common knowledge for whatever good that is, you know, and it's usually not very good, but just, you know, the kind of like everybody knows knowledge would say, well, it's of course that's the situation. Black women get worse treatment, and it's just sort of an accepted part. You know, people look at that's the reality, and what you're saying is that that's not the reality.
No, we do agree, and we absolutely don't want to be misinterpreted. Mm-hmm. Black women get worse treatment. And we document that in the paper. It's just that when they're diagnosed at such a late stage, early on, and when they're first present with their disease, that difference in treatment, though it's unacceptable, isn't what's driving the difference in survival. In a sense, the deck is stacked in the very beginning, so that even though blacks get worse treatment, even if their treatment was like that of whites, they still would do poorly. We have to first get at why they're presenting with such advanced disease and have so many other chronic illnesses. It's a nuanced argument, but it says, of the three-year difference in survival, 2 years of the three-year difference is really due to the fact that they come in with more advanced disease and they come in with larger tumors and a lot more chronic illnesses. I'll give you an example. Stage 4 disease, whites come in on average with about a 5% stage 4 rate, which is the most advanced disease. Blacks come in with close to 9%, almost a doubling. In terms of the tumor size, tumors greater than 4 centimeters, whites, about 11% have that, blacks, 22%. So blacks are coming in with much worse initial presentation factors. So the system is failing, And the game of trying to improve this is just we are losing that in the very beginning because we are doing so poorly in the way black patients present at the time of diagnosis. Other problems, diabetes. Whites have about a 15% rate of diabetes. Blacks, 26%. Now, this data was all from the Medicare population. These are patients 65 and older, and I think we have to stress that that's what this study was about. These are blacks and whites in the Medicare population, where about 40% of breast cancers occur. Heart failure also is much higher in blacks than whites. So the problem is at the very beginning when patients are diagnosed. And if we could get rid of that difference in presentation, which is counting for 2 years of the 3 years in the survival disparity, then it would probably be the case that these treatment differences that we did see, there are disparities in treatment, they would become more important because patients would be presenting with more treatable disease early on. And then if you didn't get the right treatment, there would probably be a bigger impact from the disparity in treatment.
Yeah, exactly. Very important. And that in fact was where I was trying to go with that question, was that because I know you do, as you're saying, you do talk about that you recognize the unequal treatment, but that's not the deciding factor in terms of what you were studying, what you revealed. I'm Michael Slater, and we're talking today with Dr. Jeffrey Silber, director of the Center for Outcomes Research at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and we're talking about a study that Dr. Silber was the lead author on, which compared the higher mortality rates of black women with breast cancer and white women who have the same disease. And we're talking about the reasons why. You know, you also said this thing, and this really was, I found intriguing too, because you said, okay, your study concentrated on women that were 65 and older, but then you said that if you studied women younger, and taking into consideration this, what the subject we've just been talking about, the impact of treatment and how the presentation when you're diagnosed and the rest of this, you said that if your study was focused on women younger than 65, that the gap would be even wider.
Well, I suspect that our data was about women older than 65 and in the Medicare population. But remember, all of these patients had insurance. So you can imagine that in a younger population that doesn't have insurance, that these differences would be even larger. That was my point when I made that. So, you know, I don't want to extrapolate too much into the younger population. This study was with Medicare patients, which is a huge population in and of itself. But my suspicion is that things are only worse if we would have looked at data at an earlier age.
Now, one thing here, and I'm not sure I'll pose the question. You can tell me. Well, we've already spoken to that, but I think actually there's something more to dig into here where you said your study said that if black women began treatment earlier, the survival gap between blacks and whites would grow.
Now, actually, you're quoting a misquote, or it wasn't a quotation. You're quoting from the L.A. Times.
Right,
they're
yeah.
actually putting a
yeah.
retraction out on that. They,
oh, good.
Get the story right. So let me clear that up here. No, if blacks would present like whites, the survival difference would improve by about 2 years. That's absolutely. What I was trying to explain, and maybe they didn't quite understand, was that if we were in this great position where blacks presented like whites and they came in with the same numbers of early-stage disease versus late-stage disease, then the treatment disparity that we do see would become more important, which is what I kind of explained earlier. That, you know, if patients come in with such advanced disease that any kind of treatment isn't going to make huge differences from a population point of view. Remember, on an individual basis, you can have advanced disease and do very well. But from a population basis, because blacks come in with such advanced disease, the treatments that we have in general aren't going to be as effective as if they would have come in with earlier disease that is more treatable. So if we got everyone to come in earlier, and if there still was a disparity in the way patients were treated, that disparity would show up as an even bigger disparity in survival in that group that are all living now 2 years more. So overall, survival would be much better if we could reduce the presentation disparity or the problem at diagnosis. But then, if that was the case, we'd have to concentrate even harder on any disparities in treatment. Right now, what our study is saying is we've got to do both. We've got to get rid of any disparities in treatment, but we really have to redouble our efforts on trying to improve how blacks present at diagnosis, which means better primary care, which means better mammography rates. Our study showed that blacks get less mammography than whites in this matched sample. They also get less colon cancer screening. They get less cholesterol screening. They have less often a primary care provider, and these are all patients that have insurance. These are Medicare patients. So we really have to work harder at these core preventative issues if we're going to try to get rid of this disparity in survival that we're seeing.
Mm-hmm. We're talking today with Dr. Jeffrey Silber, director of the Center for Outcomes Research at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And we're talking about a new study that Dr. Silber was the lead author on, which compared the higher mortality rates of black women and white women with the same disease. And we're talking about the causes behind it. Now, one of the things, I want to come back to that in a minute, but one of the things that you've said too, and I think it's related to that, I want to actually understand this. You mentioned, you talked about, well, you know, the women came from similar backgrounds and that they all had insurance and things like that. But what about in terms of circumstances? Like, for instance, if a black woman comes in and she's got Medicare, but she also doesn't have a visible means of support, lives right on the edge of survival, and a white woman comes in and she's living in Bel Air or something, there's a difference there, you know, even whatever, whether she had Medicare or didn't have Medicare. But then what if you take a woman, a white woman who has exactly the same circumstances of life as a black woman? What happens then?
Well, my suspicion is that income does play a role in this. And in our study, we didn't want to analyze income separately from race because race and income are so closely related. Mm-hmm. But I would say that this same finding of presenting with worse disease probably occurs in patients with lower income as well. And it would be a finding that we would hope would help all patients, whether they're white or black. Income in America has a huge effect on your health outcomes.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things I wanted to ask, too, was that you talked about this is actually kind of it's very, very heavy when you mentioned all the things that black people don't get in terms of medical care before you actually get diagnosed around something and on all kinds of different fronts, whether it's screening for diabetes, whether it's screening for colon cancer, whether it's screening for cholesterol, all this other stuff. You know, this is very much tied in into the whole way of life that's forced on black people in general in this society. And I remember I used to work in VD clinics in New York, and I remember that one of the hardest things we had to do was to go out to people and to get people to actually come into the clinics to be, if they had some problem, to come into the clinics and be screened for the, you know, be tested for venereal disease of whatever kind and treated. And people had, there was a lot of mythology that went on around this. You know, the clinics were available, but a lot of people didn't even know the clinics were there. And it seems like this is a mammoth sociological problem that has to be taken on as well as a direct medical problem.
I absolutely agree. And we're hoping that this report will, you know, increase efforts to look at all of those issues. For example, just having a trusting relationship with your primary care provider might go a long way in having you come in earlier if you feel a lump. Just having a good relationship with your primary care provider might induce you to do more screening or get the mammography that you need. You know, there are so many problems with the healthcare system. Every time we look at this in any way, we see huge disparities, both by race and by income. And so it's not that this study is going to change all of American healthcare, but I think it contributes to a literature and to a general knowledge that says things are very wrong. We can't continue to do the things that we do at present, or else patients are going to continue to suffer.
Exactly. And I think I, for one, think your study is extremely important in terms of people actually understanding what the conditions of life are for black people, what the conditions of life around questions like this, and as well as even more broadly, what it implies about broad conditions of life and the need for people to recognize that and to stand up and say, we're not going to tolerate this anymore. So, Dr. Silber, I want to thank you very much for this study and for coming on the show.
Well, thank you very much, Michael.
Okay, I'll talk to you again sometime soon. Next time you have another study, call me, man.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care now. All right, you are listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Dr. Jeffrey Silber. Dr. Silber is the director of the Center for Outcomes Research at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and he's the lead author of a study on the higher mortality rates of black women with breast cancer when compared to white women and the causes behind that, as you've just heard. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Sansara Taylor and Riley to talk about the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, what it's all about, what's going on, and wow, what a great, great, great event. So stay tuned.
It was 8:49 on a beautiful ninth day of July. There was not a cloud to speak of, so the orange sun hung lonely in the sky. I lay prone in my cabbie home, thinking of fine nappy Jackie and his jazz cat's horn, sliding in a tape of Bird on Bird when suddenly rang my phone. Hey, butterfly, the voice said, slip on some duds, comb out your fro, and slide on down to my pad. The vibe here is very pleasant, and I truly request your presence. A problem of great magnitude has arose, and as we speak, it grows. Damn, what could it be, I thought? A juice I bought,
and rolled on down to her spot. Seeing bros I know slapping fives, I arrived and pressed G5. And there was Nikki, looking some kind of sad with tears falling from her eyes. She sat me down and dug my frown and began to run it down. You remember my boyfriend Sid, that fly kid who I love? Well, our love was often a verb, and spontaneity has brought a third. But due to our youth and economic state, we wish to terminate. About this we don't feel great, but baby, that's how it is. But the feds have dissed me, they ignored and dismissed me. The pro-lifers harassed me outside the clinic and called me a murderer. Now that's hate. So needless to say, we're in a mental state of debate. Hey, beautiful bird, I said, digging her somber mood. The fascists are some heavy dudes. They don't really give a damn about life. They just don't want a woman to control her body or have the right to choose. But baby, that ain't nothing. They just want a male finger on the button. Because if you say war, they will send them to die by the score. Aborting missions should be your volition. But if Suda and Thomas have their way, you'll be standing in line unable to get welfare while they'll be out hunting and fishing. It has always been around. It will always have a niche. But they'll make it a privilege, not a right, accessible only to the rich. Hey, pro-lifers need to dig themselves, because life don't stop after birth. And for a child born to the unprepared, it might even just get worse. The situation would surely change if they were to find themselves in it. Supporters of the H-bomb and firebombing clinics. What type of sh** is that? Orwellian, in fact. If Roe v. Wade was overturned, would not the desire remain intact? Leaving young girls to risk their health, doctors to botch and watch as they kill themselves. Now, I hate to sound macabre, but hey, isn't it my job to lay it on the masses and get them off their asses to fight against these fascists? So, whatever you decide, make that move with pride. Sid will be there.
All right, all right. Welcome back. One of the one of the best songs out there talking about abortion and the woman's right to abortion. It's La Femme Fatale, La Femme Fatale. All right. And it's from Diggable Planets and their album Reaching. And it's just one of those albums, one of those songs that just sort of, it's there and people got to find it and make it a lot more popular today. All right. So check that out. Again, it's Diggable Planets. All right. I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Sansara Taylor and Riley. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and she's also one of the initiators of StopPatriarchy.org. And she's actually joining with other volunteers, with other people from all over the country, to be on the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, a major counteroffensive against the anti-abortion fascists. And Riley is one of those volunteers. And Sansara and Riley are here to talk with us about their experiences, their goals, what's going on, what they plan, everything else. Sansara, Riley, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's great
Hi.
To be with you.
Hi. Good for both of you. All right. So let's jump into this. Sansara, maybe you can start off right away and talking about, tell people what this Abortion Rights Freedom Ride is and what it's all about.
Well, as I think most of your listeners know, abortion rights in this country are in a total state of emergency all across the country, almost any state, Texas, North Carolina, North Dakota, Arizona, Alabama, new restrictions, record restrictions, 3 years in a row, and this year is the most severe yet. And so we have launched StopPatriarchy.org. We have launched a 15-state, one-month-long abortion rights freedom ride, where we kicked off just a couple of days ago with rallies in both San Francisco and New York, and we've begun caravanning. Right now we're in Ohio. We spent yesterday in Cleveland having a rally. There were caravanning and holding rallies and protests around abortion rights in states all across this country, especially converging in Fargo, North Dakota, right as laws are scheduled to go into effect that would close down the last abortion clinic there on August 1st. We expect an injunction, but we're going to be there either way. We're going down to Wichita, Kansas, where Dr. George Tiller was assassinated 4 years ago, and where they've finally, after years of struggle, reopened an abortion clinic there, and now the new owner is receiving serious threats and harassment, death threats. And then we'll be culminating on August 17th. We're making other stops, but we culminate August 17th down in Jackson, Mississippi, where there is the last abortion clinic in all of Mississippi serving huge numbers of poor women, rural women, black women in the South. It is only open, that clinic, because of a temporary injunction against a law that would close it. And we are aiming to do with this tour three things: shine a national spotlight and launch a national counteroffensive against all of these attacks, a national counteroffensive to really get people off the defensive about abortion, to say abortion on demand without apology. This fight has never been about babies. It has always been about control over women. We should be vocal and unapologetic about that. And the third thing is to really tell people the truth, that there's not going to be a politician that is going to stop these attacks or a court order that is going to restrain this Christian fascist juggernaut. It is going to take massive political struggle, people getting off the sidelines, out in the streets with us, joining with us on this caravan, and in other ways going forward. So that's sort of, it's hard to compress down a month-long epic struggle, but that's my best attempt for you, Michael.
Pretty good. And I got to tell people, we are going to feature the Abortion Rights Freedom Riders as a regular feature of the show for the duration of the Freedom Ride. This is going to be an extremely important element of this show and getting the word out here and across the country around this. So we look forward to talking with you about that. So we'll have a lot more time to explore a lot of the questions that you raised and especially how it's going in relation to the whole tour. Now, I'd like to ask Riley a question. Riley, I don't know you. I'd like to hear who you are and what made you want to come on this Freedom Ride.
Okay, well, hi, Michael.
Hi.
Well, I've been involved with Star Patriarchy for a little over a year now, and through getting more involved with this network and, you know, I've become a revolutionary in the past year, and I've really recognized, you know, where all of these things stem from and what it's actually going to take to change it, and this action is really, you know, a key example of really digging into this question of the oppression of women and what it's going to actually take to uproot that. And, you know, I come from, you know, I went to school and really for women's studies and really got into these questions, but it was still in the framework of, you know, an institution, and it wasn't really allowing people to really try to dig into, well, what is it really going to take to change all of this? And I was really always constantly struggling with just being left at the end of class with, well, okay, that's just the way it is, you know, and it was just, to me, it wasn't right, and I sought out what was the answer to all of this. And working with Sansar, I've really been recognizing what it's actually going to take. And doing this, I've really come to see that these restrictions that are coming down left and right, state by state, they have nothing to do with safety for women or, you know, any kind of medical necessity whatsoever. Abortion is one of the most common and safe procedures for women. 1 in 3 women will have one in her lifetime. And abortion is actually even safer than giving birth to a child. And people need to recognize that taking away women's access to this is actually dangerous. And because of this, as it keeps on happening in this way, you know, going in this direction, women will just get more and more desperate and make more and more desperate decisions on how they will obtain an abortion. And ultimately, women will die because of this. Or, on the other side of it, they'll be forced into motherhood. And neither of these options are acceptable if women are going to be viewed as full human beings. Women's lives are at stake here, and people need to recognize this and act on it. And that's what I'm doing here.
Okay, good. Well, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, who's a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and Riley, and they are both members of the StopPatriarchy.org, and they're in the middle of, or in the beginning of, not the middle of, they're in the beginning, they're just kicking this off, a freedom ride, the abortion rights freedom ride that's going to a huge, you heard Sansara earlier, going to a huge number of cities, different parts of the country, and they're stepping up against this fascist offensive. They're launching a major counteroffensive to this fascist offensive, which I have to tell you, when I listened to you know, that song that I played earlier, the Diggable Planet song of Femme Fetal, you know, it's sort of it really struck me as even back then where they were talking about that there were these fascists out there trying to stop women from having abortions and the whole assault on women as humans, on the humanity of women. And yet I thought, okay, that was like a long time ago. And you think about how much this has progressed now. You know, and what we're up against now, what humanity is up against, not just what women are up against, but anyone who gives a damn about humanity is up against in relation to this, the assault on abortion rights and the assault on women that's concentrated in that assault on abortion rights. And sorry, I wanted to know one thing from you. What kind of response have you been getting around this?
Well, we've been just beginning, but we've touched a very, very deep nerve with people. One of the reasons we're doing this Freedom Ride is that we understand that there is a tremendous reservoir of literally millions and millions of people in this country who do not want to see women forced to have children against their will. We know there are people who feel strongly about this, but we also know that most people feel very defensive saying the word abortion, telling their own stories. There's so much stigma. People don't tell their closest friends or family that they've had an abortion, and much less talk about it publicly. There's stigma, there's fear, there's all of this, and our premise, our understanding in doing this was that those people are out there, we have to call them forward. And since, even before we launched this, we put out the word that we're doing this abortion rights freedom ride. We put out a statement called Abortion on Demand Without Apology for Every Woman in Every State. The reversal of abortion rights and birth control must stop now. And we published this online. We received hundreds of signatures and comments from people all over the country, and including in places that everybody thinks, oh, you can't get support for this there, like little towns in North Dakota and Kentucky and Alabama, all over this country and actually around the world. But then now that we've begun to launch and we had our kickoff rallies in New York and San Francisco on Tuesday, yesterday we had a rally in Cleveland. I just want to share a little bit because we were in Union Square in New York City and we had this rally and we called on people, among other things, to tell their stories of abortion, to bring this out of the shadows and the secrecy. There shouldn't be shame about it. It's not selfish. It's not wrong. Fetuses are not babies. Abortion is not murder, and women are not incubators. So we called on this. And one of the people who I found, you know, there was a lot of tremendous things that were shared, but there was one woman, I was actually just walking through the crowd, and a friend of mine came and said, you got to talk to this woman. And I looked, and there was this woman, and she was very soft-spoken and actually kind of shaking and crying as she told me about a very dear friend of hers back when she was growing up in Biloxi, Mississippi, who was 16 years old in 1970 and found out that she was pregnant. She was raised Catholic in Mississippi and was so terrified that she went home when she found out. She couldn't tell her family. She shot herself and killed herself. And this woman has carried this story with her. And so she came up on stage. You know, she was afraid to do it, but then she did it. And she came up on stage and honored her friend's memory and spoke on behalf of millions of women whose you know, 70,000 women die every year from illegal abortions or botched abortions around the world. Spoke on behalf of not just her friend, but all these women now and all the women whose futures are at stake. And it was really an act of tremendous heart and courage. And we've seen this. We've seen this. She did this. Other people. I'm not going to tell every story because we don't have time. But it's the sharing and the strength that's been tapped into. And then in Cleveland yesterday, we did a march through downtown, and we're hoping to get up some video footage of some of the people we interviewed along the sidelines, because there was the people who came out and protested with us who were quite impressive, and then there was the passerby who really, you know, we're enthusiastic. Many of them were very enthusiastic to see people standing up for this right. Especially, there was a lot of black women we actually saw in Cleveland downtown yesterday who were nodding when they saw this, who were putting their fists up when we were marching and agitating. And you know, there's something that has to come to the surface, and so we're discovering it. Our mission is to bring it much more forcefully forward and to build as we go. I do want to make sure that we call on everybody who's listening. Everybody who's listening has a stake in the success of this freedom ride. We're not doing this to say, hey, we did something really, really great, and hey, you should know about it. The point is, there really is a future of women is at stake. Everybody has a stake in this freedom ride becoming more and more powerful, calling forth more and more voices. Everybody who's listening, you could become part of this. You could fly into Mississippi and join us on August 17th. You could come to Wichita. You could be part of the caravan, or you could be a virtual freedom rider. And you should connect with us on Twitter @StopPatriarchy, on Facebook @StopPatriarchy, or on our website, StopPatriarchy.org, and connect with us and be part of following this. Be part of amplifying what we're doing, the stories that we're blogging about and coming out about this. Share this and share your own story. Write in a message and be part of this nationwide counteroffensive.
Real quick, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, who's a writer for Revolution Newspaper and one of the initiators of StopPatriarchy.org. And we're also joined by Riley, who is a volunteer on the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, which Sansara and Riley are taking part in, along with a whole crew of volunteers, and are going to all of the critical places in the country to stand up and launch a major national counteroffensive against all those fascists attacking the right of women to have an abortion, and to say loud and clear, we are human, and we demand to be treated as such. Now, let me ask Riley, let me ask you a question about this. Naming this the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride harkens back to and conjures up a very powerful time in the movement against oppression in this country and frankly around the world, the Freedom Riders in the early 1960s. What do you think about that link between what was going on at that time and what's going on now and what's needed now in relation to abortion rights? Can you talk about that a little?
Riley. Oh, okay. She's having signal trouble. We're out in the cornfields of Ohio on the side of the, you know, stopped to make the call. So this is Sansara. She can't.
All right. I'm scared of cornfields. I'm very scared of cornfields. So let's just have you talk then. Okay. Let's talk about that.
Okay. Well, I think we did very intentionally model ourselves and harken back to the original Freedom Ride in what we're doing. And we did that for a number of reasons. One is because what is at stake for women? And people need to understand this. Forced motherhood is female enslavement. It really is. It is a question of the enslavement of women, and it's not anything less than that. And so the stakes for women are just as high as the stakes were for black people during the Freedom Rides, the original Freedom Rides. And there is something of people, look, the form is different. The history doesn't repeat itself exactly, but the parallel is there, and people need to confront this is a moment. These are the days and weeks and months around which the shape of the future of women is being hammered into place through the power of the state, through legislating women's rights and women's futures out of existence. And this is a moment when people really do have to put a lot on the line. They have to change what they're doing. The traditional, the conventional wisdom among pro-choice people of just elect some officials and hope they'll deal with it, and these crazy Christian fascists are so lunatic, everybody can see through them. They'll never get very far. Todd Akin, he says legitimate rape, oh, but nobody takes him seriously. No. These are people. Whether Todd Akin himself stays in office or not is not the point. This Christian fascist program is gaining ground. It's being hammered into place, and the Democrats are seeking common ground with it time and time again, and it's going to require, just like the civil rights struggle did, it's going to require people putting themselves out there, relying on themselves, relying on ourselves, taking the future into our hands and risking something and rocking the boat. The boat is going in a bad direction. We need to change that direction. And this is what we're trying to do with this Freedom Ride. We're going into the places where this battle is the most extreme. And let's be honest as well. It is a life and death battle, both for the future of women and for the people who are already on the front lines. Doctors, providers, they get killed in this field. There's no other medical profession that has been assassinated for providing their services. Abortion providers risk their lives every day. It is a life and death thing, and we're taking it very seriously as we go out on the road, and it's another reason why we're calling on people to support this Freedom Ride, to have our backs. We're not looking for a provocation, but we understand that there are forces, very powerful forces, and very deadly forces who really hate the mission that we're on.
And on that note, Sansara, we're going to have to wrap this up. And I want to say, all of that reflects the intense importance of what's going on with this Freedom Ride. And we will have you on each and every week until it's over. All right. So stay with us and keep up. And we'll talk to you again next week.
OK, thank you so much, Michael.
Sure, Sansara. Take care. Riley, take care. Bye now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we've just been talking with Sansara Taylor and Riley from StopPatriarchy.org, and they're both part of the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride that's going through the country, North Dakota, Wichita, Kansas, Mississippi, and fighting around abortion rights and taking a stand. Just like the other original Freedom Rides, a whole hell of a lot is at stake. The very humanity of women is at stake. And frankly, for all of us, it's a big question. Okay, well, that just about brings our show to an end. But before we go, a very important announcement I want to make to people. Listeners who heard my show last week will remember that one of my guests was Gregory Koger, a revolutionary communist and a former prisoner who had spent 6 years in solitary confinement, and in fact became a revolutionary while he was in solitary confinement. Well, on July 23rd, Gregory Koger was taken from a courtroom in Illinois and sent back to Cook County Jail in Chicago to serve the remainder of a 300-day sentence. Gregory had been convicted of trespass and resisting arrest almost 4 years ago for filming a statement against censorship delivered by Sansara Taylor at a gathering of the Ethical Humanist Society of Chicago. But this case has never been about trespass or resisting arrest. It has been about the political prosecution of a revolutionary. Over the last few weeks, Gregory has been a powerful voice speaking out in support of the California prisoners' hunger strike and speaking from his personal experience, laying bare the reality that solitary confinement equals torture. The courtroom process that sent Gregory back to jail
was described as akin to a secret trial with all kinds of hidden machinations by the judge and the prosecutor aimed at putting Gregory back in prison. When Gregory went into the Cook County Jail, he immediately began a hunger strike in solidarity with the California prisoners' hunger strike. And the prison officials retaliated, sending Gregory to multiple sessions of psychological evaluation for his joining the hunger strike. People need to stand up against this, have Gregory's back, and insist that Gregory Koger be released from jail immediately. And I really recommend that everyone check out the site revcom.us, that's R-E-V as in Victor, C-O-M as in Michael, .us, that's U-S. All right, check that site out to find out more information about Gregory and how you can show your support. And now I want to thank all of my guests for today. Marilyn McMahon, the Executive Director of the California Prison Focus. Dr. Jeffrey Silber, the Director of the Center for Outcomes Research at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And Sansara Taylor and Riley, who are part of the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride. And we're going to hear a lot more about that in the weeks to come. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant and intern, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Federico Garcia. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow me, again, in a cool way, you can do that at Twitter and Facebook. And now we're going to go out with a song that I've been listening to endlessly since the album just came out. It's Gogo Bordello's latest album, Pura Vida Conspiracy. And the song is We Rise Again. Talk to you again next week. Wataka wataka, here we come, ataka taka. Wataka wataka, here we come. Wataka wataka, here we come, ataka taka. Wataka wataka, here we come. We never give up on a philosopher's stone. I guess anything you wanna do, you gotta do it on your own. For a love of you, for a love of me, for a love of everyone who's yet to be free. Borders are scars on face of the planet, so heal away my alchemy man. Even atheist holds up the candle. We rise again. We rise again with a fistful of heart and a relic of future.